Good day and welcome to the Access Bank PLC's full year 2012 results conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Aig Imukwedi, CEO. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon or good morning, depending on what part of the world you dialed in from. Welcome to Access Bank's full year 2012 and first quarter year 2013 results presentation. For the convenience of our participants, our analysts, our shareholders and investors who call in, we try to minimize traditionally the inconvenience of calling two conference calls within 30 days to take full year as well as Q1 figures. So what we tend to do is that we combine these two presentations in one call in April. Both the audited 2012 and the management 2013 numbers have been hosted on our website. We have also published the PowerPoint presentation that we will be taking you through on the website of the bank. We do this to ensure that callers can keep track of the presentation, and we will refer you to the PowerPoint page that we are on as we go along. With me on the call are Ebenezer Olufowose, Executive Director, Financial Markets; Victor Etuoku, Executive Director, Personal and Business Banking; Okemuke, Executive Director, Institutional Banking; Roosevelt Ogbunna, Senior Vice President, Commercial Banking; Shegu Ogbunnewo, who heads our Transaction Banking business; Mr. Greg Jobume, the Chief Risk Officer of the bank; Shei Kumakwai, the Chief Financial Officer of the bank; Herbert Wigwe, my deputy, is hunting for business in North America; and one other ED, Obiaho Ohiwere, is on vacation. Now, if we turn to page 3 of the presentation, you will find the agenda. I will be taking us through, by way of opening the presentation, the overview of Access Bank, and this will provide you background and context, particularly those who are not very familiar with our bank, to the story you'll be listening to today. Thereafter, the CFO, Shei, will take us through the presentation, and then we'll go into questions and answers. On slide 4, we seek to capture in one page our 11-year journey since 2002, when this transformation, what we call our transformation project, began. Essentially, back then in 2002, from quite an obscure fourth-tier position, we set our sights on significant shareholder value maximization and doing this by growing. And we have grown indeed. Initially, we calibrated targets around a five-year growth trajectory that would see us move from number 65 or so to a top 10 position in 2007. And our story has combined both organic as well as inorganic growth to achieve this. We are just concluding what we call phase 2, which, if you look on the slide, takes you between 2007 and 2012, where we have basically emerged as one of Nigeria's top 5 financial services groups, and several other parameters that we set for ourselves on a balanced scorecard basis pertaining to service delivery, product leadership, and so on. Having successfully covered our first two phases of growth, we're entering into our third phase, and it's all about attaining market leadership and a position of preeminence in every country where we are present. I must add that the significant wealth that was created over the past 11 years still continues to be the primary focus of the management team of the bank. And so that which we seek to achieve over the next 5 years is all centered around shareholder value maximization. On slide 5, essentially, we are looking here at 4 key qualitative characteristics of Access Bank: a bank of best practice in terms of how we conduct ourselves as a corporate organization and do the business of banking, with extremely strong prudent financial stability indicators, market-leading share of customer accounts and transaction count in Nigeria with an experienced board, and with humility I say a well-respected management team known for corporate governance and compliance. Slide 6 is really just a fact sheet. It includes, amongst other things, the bank's credit ratings from S&P, Fitch, and Augusto. And basically, today you are talking to a bank, or you are hearing from a bank that finds itself in the first tier of Nigerian banks along both financial and qualitative criteria. On slide 7, we give a very brief economic overview. On the economic front, Nigeria basically remained largely unaffected by the muted growth you found in most G8 countries. Across most key macroeconomic data and indices, we maintained or improved our scorecard as a nation. A lot of this is due to the Central Bank of Nigeria, holding a tight handle on monetary policy, and introducing several regulations, both for the conduct of banking, but also that have influenced the way, the financial markets have operated. With respect to those around banking business, we'll speak a bit more about this later. In terms of rates, the monetary policy rate remains largely unchanged at 12% for the year. Reserve ratios are still quite strict. The outlook for 2013 is the possibility of monetary easing towards the end of the year. On slide 8, as I earlier highlighted, we are digesting an acquisition. When I was talking about our story, I spoke about the fact that both organic and inorganic growth paths have been followed by us in achieving some of the successes that we believe that we have recorded over time. Following our successful acquisition of Intercontinental Bank in 2011, we are beginning to see significant benefits accreting to the bank. I think it's important for me to point out that a number of commentators, so to speak, around about 2000, when we first announced our intention to pursue this acquisition, highlighted the challenges that this acquisition would bring for the institution. And I dare say there were a few who thought that we shouldn't go ahead and pursue the transaction. For the most part, the challenges were real, and we didn't shy away from them. But I think what is most important is that we are reaping the benefits that we saw and which made it worth our while to pursue this acquisition. Particularly in the areas of efficiencies of scale and scope, you find that at the bottom of the slide. Essentially, we've gone from an ROE of 9% to within 1 year post-acquisition, 18%, essentially doubling ROE. This is, this is significant if you do typical M&A, arithmetic. And over the next few years, we expect to see much more significant accretion from this merger. Now, on slide 9, we successfully completed in 2012 most of the heavy lifting required to integrate Intercontinental Bank into Access Bank. And I would just like to speak to some of our integration achievements. In banking, I think the most treacherous area is the whole thing about systems integration. And this we did very fast in the first quarter of 2012. We successfully cut over our various systems onto one unified service platform. And basically, if you look at other banks or other combinations that took place in 2011, I think these are things that people are just beginning to achieve now. We closed down 140 branches with minimal customer attrition and loss of deposits. We did suffer, of course, loyalty concerns, but in terms of actual deposit runoff, we lost less than 5% of our of the deposits that we took on from Intercontinental. We restructured the SBUs, particularly given the fact that we now have a very strong retail business, did redeployment of personnel appropriately to suit the type of businesses that, you know, we do in each SBU, and we did a lot of customer segmentation, which Shea will talk to later on, to ensure that the appropriate customers were served by the appropriate SBUs. HR right-sizing was completed in 2012, and we sought to retain as much as possible key talents that came from the business combination. Also related to this is the fact that we spent a lot of time and hundreds of thousands of training hours for both our what we call professional staff and our support staff. We are now at the point of disposal of idle assets such as branches and non-core assets. Now, this is by no means exhaustive, but the signal really that we are sending here is that the good news is that the heavy lifting is nearing completion, and 2013 therefore has little or no distractions for us in terms of serving our customers and winning the competitive battle for share of wallet. I'll now hand over to Shea. We are at slide 10, and Shea will take us through the rest of the presentation.
Right, thank you, Ike. I'm starting from slide 11, which essentially highlights the key performance indices for the year ended 2012. I'm looking at three areas: profitability, the balance sheet, and then, you know, around the prudential ratios. As I had mentioned, the key performance, you know, was driven by the merger. And if you looked at the all the numbers around profitability, you see them come through. PBT went up by 86%, PAT 1%, so significant improvement in profitability. Now, if you look at the on the balance sheet side of things, clearly, given that we are digesting this merger, just like I mentioned, the scope for balance sheet growth was limited because we wanted to stabilize the operations, and so really the focus was in stabilizing the operations in 2012. So you won't see significant growth on the balance sheet. So you will see very conservative growth on the balance sheet. However, we still maintain very, very strong prudential ratios. Capital adequacy is far in excess of prudential. Liquidity ratio far in excess, loan-to-deposit ratio, and after-tax, you know, ROE at 18%, double what it was, which I had alluded to earlier. So clearly, from a performance highlight, this was much better performance than we saw in 2011. And, you know, like I said, you know, it has moved us into one of the top five in Nigeria. I'll present the detail of the comprehensive income statement. If you look at the comparative between 2011 and 2012, you will see that clearly there is significant growth on the gross earnings side, coming from the huge amount of AMCON bond that was acquired from the merger. Also, on the interest expense side of things, you also see about a 78% increase. Clearly, we saw in 2012 a very lightly in the second half, an interest environment, you know, that was a bit volatile and on the high side, and this is also given an enlarged base. Now, these comparatives somewhat are different because you are looking at, for 2011, you are looking at, you know, we consolidated one quarter of ICB. Now we run a full year, and that's why some of those comparatives are the way they are. Now, in terms of non-interest income, what you find is that we have grown this very significantly, given the number of customers that we have now and the number of transactions that are going through the bank today. So really, that's a big growth area, and you see that when I present the detail of the presentation. Now, on impairment charges, it increased from about 9 to 10.7. Clearly, on the loan side, on the specific side, was actually a reduction, while on the we had to take some provision on diminution value of investment, which I will talk, you know, about when we get to the detail of the presentation. On OPEX, clearly we mentioned this in a couple of our presentations, the impact of the one-off restructuring costs and the discounting loss on the financial condition bonds that were sold in the third quarter. So this is a summary of how we performed on the income statement. I would go to slide 13. Now, slide 13 gives us how has our gross earnings looked like over the last 4 years. Clearly, what you find is that interest income continues to account for a significant portion of our revenue. You will see this begin to change as I talk to the presentation. From a geographic contribution perspective, Nigeria is still the largest. However, we are seeing the other subsidiaries, largely UK and Ghana, beginning to come strong in terms of earnings. Clearly, IGAD mentioned the restructuring of the SBUs, and you can see that that is beginning to come through from the personal and banking business side of moving from about 4% gross earnings contribution to 12% for 2012. I'm going to slide 14, essentially just to talk about the net interest margin. clearly, net interest margin has come under some pressure in the last quarter of the year, given that we had, in order to exit interbank, which we had talked at the last conference call, we saw some of the outcome bonds, and then also purchase deposit we acquired in the period, and therefore that impacted the NIM that you are seeing for financial year 2012 and for the quarter. We'll also talk about that when we look at the first quarter presentation. So really, the pressure you see on NIM, largely driven by cost of funds, which is beginning to, these deposits are beginning to run off, and we see most of the runoff in the second half of the year. But I'll talk in more detail about this in subsequent slides. On slide 15, this is around how our cost efficiency has looked like. Improvement has been limited due to this one-off charges which I've listed. There, if you look at it, you see exceptional loss of 8 billion, which is the accommodation AMCON bonds, and the integration cost of 6.3 billion. So really, this clearly has an effect on the. Even then, we still close with a cost income ratio of about 61%. Slide 17. This gives us a sense of what has happened to profitability and the shareholder value of the bank, of the group, from last year to this year and over the last 4 years. Clearly, what is coming through is that this has been enhanced. If you look at the ROE, EPS, DPS, we've seen all of this gone up. And on the basis of that, the bank is proposing a final dividend of 60 kobo per share. This is in addition to the 25 kobo per share that was paid in 2011. So really, from a profitability standpoint and from a shareholder value standpoint, this is on the increase. Slide 17 essentially looks at the balance sheet, how the balance sheet has played out, over the course of the 2 years that we are looking at. Cash and cash equivalent, very strong growth, stronger liquidity in the group, largely coming from the UK. And just like I mentioned, the cash reserve increase also meant that in the year, we had to increase the cash reserve balance to CBN, which was significant. That also contributed to what you are saying. Like I mentioned before, given the integration of 2012, we saw a conservative loan growth of about 5% for 2012. Investment security also reduced. I think we've talked about this as a result of the AMP compounds that were sold. Even then, we then increased our deposit by about 9% year on year. As you're also aware, in the year, we issued a euro bond of about $350 million, which is one of the ways you're looking at the debt securities issue. That's what's in there. So on the balance sheet side, like I said, the year was very, very strong on integration, stabilization, and therefore you won't see, the balance sheet is still strong and extremely efficient. Slide 18 essentially just gives us a sense of the the mix of the balance sheet, both on this on the asset and liability side. The mix is still strong, still in line with what we would like. We want to make it stronger and more efficient. On a quarter-on-quarter, you know, deposit actually grew by 12%, while year-on-year grew by about 9%. Investment securities, I mentioned earlier, down about 20%, you know, clearly coming from those sale of bonds. So the balance sheet is very healthy. The focus is to actually begin to reduce our cost of funding, which I'll talk about much later in my outlook. Slide 19 essentially just looks at the balance sheet, you know, what has happened on the balance sheet over the years and over the quarters. Like I mentioned before, the balance sheet only grew by about 7%, clearly propelled by our growth in deposit. Loan-to-deposit ratio also, you know, went down by about 100 basis points. Deposit growth clearly outpacing loan growth. Focus is to continue to have an appropriate balance sheet mix that will ensure that we meet our profitability projections. Slide 20 essentially looks at how the loan book is structured. If you look at the what's on the left, we have a very well diversified loan distribution across most of the key sectors that we play in: the oil and gas downstream, upstream, oil and gas services, manufacturing, telecoms. The key sectors that you pay in, and it comes out in the graph that you see. Also, from a maturity perspective, we have about maturities are clearly marked. The long dated maturities are also financed by funding of same tenor, largely from our own lending relationships with DFIs. Focus is to continue to improve the quality of our risk assets. Slide 21 essentially looks at the deposit book. Clearly, the deposit growth was constrained by the interest rate environment, like I mentioned before. Our deposit mix is still stable, even though in the last second half of the year, the mix was limited by the purchase deposit that we acquired. The focus is to run off this deposit and replace the low-cost deposit. And we've seen increasing contribution from international operations. Subsidiaries now account for 16% of group total deposits, you know, up from about 13% in 2011. On slide 22, essentially gives a sense of those stability indicators that I mentioned earlier. Capital adequacy, liquidity still remain strong. They are well enough to support our growth, and in terms of our liquidity, I mean, like I said before, well in excess of. So it's we have a very strong balance sheet and capital adequacy to support our business growth for the year and in the future. All right, in terms of asset quality indicators. Asset quality indicators have improved. If you look at the gross NPL figures, the gross NPL figures, you know, have come down, you know, from about 56% to 34, and the coverage ratios, you know, are now 110% from about 85% that we saw in 2011. Clearly, this is an improvement from where we were in 2011. Also, on the cost of risk, remains stable. From about 1.6 to about 1.7, which is in line with, you know, what we had projected and what you said this thing would be. So clearly, we've seen sustained improvement in asset quality indicators, and we believe that this will continue in the rest of the year. All right, I'm going to talk through the SBU performance, financial performance review. I'll start from slide 25. I think the slide 25 essentially is something we presented before in terms of the what each of the business segments do for us: commercial, national bank, financial markets, and the personal and business banking. So I'm not going to talk about this. Something that presented before. Slide 26. If you look at, so what we've done here is to show the contribution of the SBU's loans and advances, deposits and PBT. I think notable there is the fact that National Banking returned to profitability in 2012, contributed about 25% to PBT from a loss position in 2011. All of the issues around NPLs, you know, largely resolved, and that's why you are seeing them, you know, come back to profitability. Like I mentioned earlier, the personal and business banking group has begun to see significant growth, and you see today they contribute about 26% of the deposit book of the bank. So the SBUs, from a performance perspective, has improved performance vis-à-vis 2011, even though commercial bank accounted for 25% of PBT from about 79%. This is because the other SBUs have begun to contribute much better than they did last year. On an absolute basis, the commercial banking actually grew.
I'll take the update on our subsidiaries' rationalization. This is AIG again, which is basically on slide 29. And you have two sides. Well, if you look on the left hand part of the slide, you see banking subsidiaries and as a subtitle, and on the right hand part, non-banking subsidiaries. There are two key things that we had to do commencing from, say, December 2011. One of them was exit non-banking activities in fulfillment of the license that we chose to drive our business going for, which is an international banking license, without adopting the universal banking model. And also the fact that given the efficiency metrics that the bank was pursuing, low potential and non-core activities were things that we chose to divest from or exit. Now, on the banking subsidiary side, you find that we have obviously emphasized Ghana, UK, Rwanda as points of focus, as well as Zambia and Congo. Zambia and Congo perhaps influenced by the post regulatory capital demands, as well of course as our central bank, our primary regulator's position on capitalization of foreign subsidiaries. Basically the idea is to strengthen actually even indeed our capital position in Ghana, Rwanda and UK, dilute on a local company operation basis, Congo and Zambia. ICB UK and Access Cote d'Ivoire have been disposed of, subject of course to regulatory approval, but the deals have been done and agreed, and consideration is in escrow. As a matter of fact, actually, ICB UK is complete. And Burundi, Gambia, and for disposal. Hydrocarbon activity in Sierra Leone could be a game changer, and so whilst the position of the bank is to seek a divestment, we will communicate to you if our position in terms of the potential of the market changes and therefore influences our decision in that regard. On the non-banking subsidiary side, I mean, the move is to exit all of them. And those in orange with the number 5 are all being liquidated. Indeed, actually, the 5 inherited, the capital market subsidiaries inherited from ICB are being handled by one liquidator. And then the commencement of a housing finance subsidiary, which commenced in Access Bank, I think 2010, and which we stopped once we chose to pursue the merger, that has been basically wound up and is in the process of being liquidated. The Interconnectal Home Savings and Loans and Blue Microfinance have been sold and are in the same, you know, position basically as ICB UK. And we have a number of other, you know, non-operational subsidiaries that have all been disposed of. WAPIC, our insurance play, will be divested, you know, by, you know, through a spin-off during the course of the year. Now, on slide 31, you have the strategy outlook for the bank for 2013. And obviously, I chose to take these two slides, given, well, more for this slide, given its importance. There are a number of key activities that are taking place for us this year, but we have moved from, these are activities that are not related to integration and are more related to transformation, business continuity, and if you like, shareholder value maximization. As I had announced, in a sense, about 18 months ago, I will be retiring at the end of this year. And you find that the formal announcement would be made sometime like June. All of this is subject, of course, to, and will be handled by our board. I will hand over to my successor in the quarter that ends September 2013, and of course, I will be pulled out of the bank December 2013. We are also finalizing our five-year corporate strategy plan, and that is something that is almost complete, actually, and is quite frankly, it's a bold transformational plan. It's been a process that has been very involving, very engaging. It's been driven more by Herbert than myself, because he will drive its implementation. I have supported and provided the enablement for the planning process to go smoothly. And we will be announcing around about June this plan and what it implies for our customers and our shareholders. Branch and premises transformation continues, and we hope to conclude that by September. The head office of Access Bank has been a work in progress since January 2012. We've been working around, literally we sit in the office and contractors move up and down. But this is all part of the desire to integrate fast and hit the ground running, you know, as fast as possible. I would like to invite as many investors to this head office. I think, you know, those who haven't seen it will be very pleased with the transformation, particularly with regard to things that drive business and ensure that our customers and our employees have the best experience that drives productivity. We're also strengthening even further our risk and financial management frameworks. One of them is that we want to ensure that our risk management, particularly our credit origination processes, are customer-friendly without in any way diluting or detracting from the need to maintain high-risk standards. Of course, minimize operational risk, and the MPL is something we constantly watch. One of our game changers is the retail banking area, and part of the SBU plan has been focused on the retail bank. And, you know, I guess, you know, let me hold our thunder where this is concerned and wait to hear from us. The operating model will continue to be implemented following the restructuring of SBUs and ensuring that the various customer segments in Nigeria are properly served by us. IT is an area that is fundamental to our strategy, the speed that we seek to achieve, and the transaction processing security will not be enabled without IT. We've made most of the investments, done most of the installing, but it's more all about capability enhancement and ensuring that all our disparate systems, you know, speak seamlessly and synchronize seamlessly with each other. I've already spoken to you about rationalization of subsidiaries, but all of that will be completed 2013. Human resource optimization continues, but we are done with rationalization. This is more recruitment and continuous training. The Access Bank School of Excellence continues to power on. We are going to bring in 500 of the best graduates from African universities into our training facilities this year, and of course they will join the bank, and we continue in that regard. We are now ramping up the sale of idle branches and investment properties, and also this year marks, you know, the beginning of PwC's audit of Access Bank, you know, following KPMG's serving out their maximum period in line with the central bank's policies on corporate governance. Now, on slide 32, we felt that whilst giving you the view on the strategic side, we should also give you the view on the operational side. And 2013 is all about growing the bank's loan portfolio by 15%, increasing our trade finance market share from 10 to 12. This is an error. I'm not sure that our competitors will allow us to drive them out of the market to this degree. So it's 12%, which in itself is quite a lot. Significant uplift of retail and channeled activities, and of course, consequently, non-interest income. Shehi has spoken about the expensive term deposit ramp-up in the third and fourth quarter 2012, and we've been replacing that from Q1 2013 with low-cost funds as we pay out those term deposits. Reduced cost of operational risk. We're a much bigger bank. We control about 8 to 10% of transaction volume in Nigeria, and of course the associated operational risks have to be strongly monitored and kept under control. We have quite a lot of written-off loans coming from Intercontinental Bank, and of course recoveries on this line go straight to the bottom line. I guess our chief risk officer will be talking about that in Q&A. Eliminate negative contribution from subsidiaries, which were a significant future of 2012 and to a much lesser degree, you know, also featured in 2013. One big deal for us is the whole issue of our franchise. The enterprise is a very powerful enterprise, and SBU cross-selling and cross-selling opportunities across value chains is really the sweet spot that we have to hit, and it's something that we're going to drive very aggressively. You can imagine, of course, that inorganic growth tends to act as a kind of dislocation to such opportunities, so following a merger is something you have to batten down, but we've done the integration and now it's time to drive those synergies. And then finally, and maybe in a sense, probably most important, enhancing customer service and retail product delivery effectiveness. So I'll ask Shehi now to go to Q1 2013 financial performance.
Thank you, Ike. I'll take us through the Q1 performance highlights. Like I mentioned earlier, Q1, we saw a contraction in our earning assets, and essentially because we are not the pace of loan growth that we had projected didn't happen as fast as we had thought, as well as the cost of funds, expensive cost money that we had on the books. So what you find is that when you compare Q1Q, profitability indices were down. By the time we talk about what the outlook is, you will see, you know, where we are going to make up where we are going to make up this number. On the total balance sheet side, I mean, nothing much has happened in terms of on the balance sheet between in the last. So this is Q4 and Q1. While on the prudential ratios, I mean, that is still continues to remain very very strong. I'll go to the numbers to give you more detail about the performance that I talked about. On slide 34, what you have is the statement of comprehensive income. Like I mentioned earlier, we saw a reduction in the interest income of about 20%. Two things. First of all, the AMCON bonds, about $1.3 billion that we disposed in Q3, we did not, at the end of Q1, replace this asset. And therefore, this had a significant impact on the net interest income. Also, if you recall, at our conference call of Q1, we had said that we recognized about 2.5 billion of excess charges that we had looked at, and we have found that we had resolved the customers in Q1. So those are the two key things that drove that reduction. Also, I mean, look at the environment. 2012 was clearly, given the declining yield on government instruments in the first half of the year compared to the same period in 2012. So that also impacted the net interest income figure that you are seeing. On the net income side, I mentioned this before, this for us, and as I also said, the retail banking business is a very strong area for us in, of growth for us in 2013. So you can begin to see the growth in the non-interest income, you know, on a quarter-on-quarter basis of about 79%. So as we strengthen this retail business, we get a better hang of it. This is an area that we believe that we are going to continue to see growth. Operating expenses, clearly the AMCON surcharge rate from about 0.2 to 0.5 impacted the bank. Not just that, in 2011, it was only the Access Bank balance sheet that was used. However, in 2012, we now have a combination of the two banks. So really, what we have is double the size of the balance, as well as, you know, an increase. So the impact is quite significant from our perspective. So really, this is the what happened on the income statement. On page 30, slide 35, like I said before, our operating income clearly impacted by slow loan contracting margins, and then, like I said, retail banking is some that we are beginning to reap the synergy of revenue synergies, as well as the our restructured retail banking strategy. The margin, you know, like I said in the first part of the presentation, you know, contracted, but you will see when we give you what the next quarter will look like, you will see how this is going to begin to we are going to begin to resolve this and push this up. Slide 36 essentially also tried to give us what is happening with the cost income ratio. Clearly, I had mentioned about the AMCON expenses and then the reduction in the two sides of the P&L. We have a reduction in operating income as well as an increase in OPEX, and therefore what that did was to increase the cost income ratio from the closing figure of 61 to 69 that we have today. We will begin to also the investment in technology and in particular generally including technology and premises, you know, also have begun to seep into expenses from a depreciation perspective. On slide 37, which is the statement of financial position, balance sheet, you know, contracted slightly, like given that we have begun to run off this expensive deposit. Loan growth in the quarter only came to about 2.4. Clearly, a number of the loan drawdowns have not happened. The expansion in the telecom sector has not. All of this started happening at the end of March, and, you know, not strong enough to contribute what we are looking for on the interest income side. This will come through in the second quarter. Also, on the oil and gas side, the allocations, you know, to the independent have also been reduced, and this also has, you know, impact for loan growth that we had projected in the first half. So really, the space of loan growth that we had projected in Q1 didn't happen as fast as we had thought. Also very important was the fact that in the quarter, we completely... the interbank was completely out of our books, at least at the bank level. I will explain what you see at the group level. Runoff high cost deposits. I've mentioned that is very, very critical for us in this quarter and in the next quarter as well. Slide 38. Like I mentioned earlier, we continue to focus on diversification and as well as reducing the concentration of our loan book. And if you look at the NPL ratios, even within a quarter, we've seen it, you know, come down from about 5.3 to 5%, and then gross NPL figures also come down. So we are working very hard on this NPL ratio so that by the end of 2013, you're looking at an NPL ratio well below 5%. We expect our loan growth to be across in some of this key sector that were mentioned. Loan growth that you saw in the first quarter was driven by manufacturing, oil and gas, as well as general commerce. So the important thing here is we are working on our asset quality ratios, and we continue to even the coverage ratios from Q4 has gone up from about 110 to 117, whilst the NPL ratio has also come down from about 5.3 to 5%. In terms of some guidance for 2013, we are looking at an ROE of 22%, an ROA of about 2.8%, cost income ratio of 60, as we put down this OPEX, as well as an EPS of 228 kobo. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Shay. So thank you very much for listening to our presentation. I think it's time for us to go into Q&A. I will now request for our operator, that's a hostess, to help us coordinate the Q&A session.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question over the telephone, please press the star or asterisk key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. We will now pause for a moment to give everybody the opportunity to signal. We will take our first question from Sergi Dubin of Consilium Investment Management. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for the call and the presentation. I had two questions, one relating to 2012 results and then one on Q1 2013. With regard to 2012, could you clarify sort of what happened in the Q4 of 2012, specifically in regards to impairment charges, which seem to be jumping hugely to like 11.8 billion naira, and why is it so much higher than in the prior quarters? That's question number one. Question number two on 2012 is also what happened to operating expenses, because it seems like you were running 76 billion naira for 9 months, and then you show for full 12 months of 2012, 87 billion. So it implies that your Q4 number was something like 11 billion, which is lower than three prior quarters run rate of roughly 25 billion. So those two on 2012. And then on 2013, I was trying to sort of understand, and you made some comments on your net interest income. Could you break down how much of the net interest income decline was from the bonds, AMCOM bonds, and how much was actually from government securities? And then on non-interest income, seems like you performed very well, and it was increasing by 79%, whether you see that as sustainable for the rest of 2013. And then one little clarification I wanted just to understand with a couple numbers. When you quote your net interest margin, you show that for 2012, your net interest margin was 7.7%. And when I calculate it based on your figures on the balance sheet, I get 9.1%. So perhaps you should clarify how you calculate that. And the second clarification is, could you clarify what your other expenses are? Because it seems like it's a fairly big chunk of your operating expenses. It's 58%. And it's not clear what those are. Maybe you can just discuss what they are in more detail. Thanks very much.
Can we have another caller, please?
Do you wish to take a second question?
Yes, we like to take two questions and then we take them.
Perfect. So we'll now take our next question from Leila Adeniza from Stanbic IBTC. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. This is Leila Adeniza from Stanbic IBTC. Just a few questions. Just wanting to get a bit more color on, in terms of the disposal of subs, are you anticipating, do you have any sense of whether or not there'll be losses to come on that at this stage, and if you could give any guidance there? Also,
She seems to have cut off.
Yes, that line seems to have disconnected. We will take a next question from Bunmi Saulo of FLBN Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi there, it's Bunmi Saulo from FBN Capital. A few of my questions have already been answered or asked by Sergey, but I'll just add one more thing to the, volatile Q4. So the non-interest income line as well showed quite a big drop, which I guess may be explained, but it would be good to hear the explanation on that one as well. Now, the next question has to do with some of the line items that may not exactly be underlying or normalized performances on the P&L. So in Q4, your profit lines were distorted significantly by discontinued operations. So a bit more color on that would be helpful. And then in Q1, I know this is below the line, the other comprehensive income line was also significant, and that depressed the PAT. I know you don't necessarily show the PAT beyond that line in the slides, but obviously it affects your book value or whatever profit number you may pay dividends out of in 2013. And if I could also add a related point, the ROE that he mentioned in terms of guidance of that 22%, what ROE is that? Is that after all these items, or is it pre-other comprehensive income line? I think those are the ones I'll put out for now. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And I guess we can take our friend from Stanbic IBTC later if she can call back. Well, Shehi, you'll start, and then, you know. But before Shehi, you know, begins to take on these questions, particularly with respect to Sergey and Bumi's questions around volatility of Q4. I mean, I think that the presentation in itself has been clear as to the amount of restructuring that took place within the entirety of the enterprise during the course of 2012. And the fact that we did, you know, give guidance that to expect a normalized operating expense profile through the course of 2012 would be expecting a bit too much, and that things would normalize come 2013. The timing of a number of these expense items was a function of course, discovery, and also a function, of course, of best accounting practice. Some of these items can be accrued for or amortized over a period. Some of these items could not, etc., etc. But I will let Shehi begin to respond, and then, you know, others can, you know, chip in.
All right. Thank you, Ike. In terms of the impairment charges, I think there are two aspects to it, which is the specific and collective. Now, if you look at the account on note page 127, you will see a breakdown of how the color to this. On a specific impairment basis, we actually had a write-back. We had about 8.5 billion in charges and about 9.9 billion in write-back, reduction in provision no longer required. So we had about 1.4 billion write-back. Now, on the collective impairment, however, the way the model is built is that in the first 3 years, because you need to begin to collect loss data. So what we had used up to 2011 was that we looked at impairment on a portfolio basis. Now, as we began to collect, since we've been doing IFRS for 4 years, we began to collect data on obligors, loss data. It was time for us to revise this process to now use an obligor base to determine the PDs and to determine what comes out of collecting. So this is a one-time change in the methodology of, since we built this, we now have the loss data on obligors over it, because we wouldn't have done it in 2 years, because it would be too, the tenor would be too short for you to make a conclusion as to the historical loss data of, and so that's what has changed. So really, on an impairment basis, not that you've seen, so it's more collective than, it's more a methodology change rather than an actual, you know, loss. So if you look at the specific, actually, we actually had a write back. Now, on the operating expenses for Q4, I think there are a number of things that accounted for this. If you look at page 33, there's a disclosure around change in accounting estimates on some items of fixed assets, property, plant and equipment. One of the things that we did, having made this investment in these properties of, that we acquired, what we did was that we looked at, we revised the estimate for the useful life of this asset. And then what then that means is that the depreciation impact, you know, we reduced for the year. And so we had a write-back of about 1.1 billion, a reduction in depreciation of about 1.1 billion. Also, if you look at the previous calls, we have started making provision for diminution in investment. Now, this was recorded as part of OPEX and not as part of impairment charges. So that was reclassified to impairment charges, which was about 4 billion. So that also contributed to that. Now, the other part is the write-back of excess accruals, just like Al had mentioned. At the beginning of the year, based on how we saw what we needed to do, we were quite aggressive on some accrual lines, and we began to advert communication because of how we thought we were going to implement the retail banking strategy, the corporate strategy, about all of these things come through, and therefore we had to. So we had write back of accruals in the last quarter. So these three is what accounted for that. What you saw, like a reduction in OPEX, is essentially around. First, for changing accounting estimates for depreciation for certain assets that were acquired, diminution in value of investment that was actually there but moved, reclassified, as well as write back of excess accruals. You also wanted to talk about there was a question around non-interest income. Now, with respect to non-interest income, I mentioned the issue of the restructured SBUs. So further to this, we have begun to engage the customers, begin to drive transactions. So this is more getting to know the customers, engaging the customers, and getting them to start doing business with you. We've set up a very elaborate personal and business banking division, which is well staffed with people. We've set up a call center that calls people. So really, all of this is what is coming through. In the non-interest income side, largely. I think that deals with the.
I think also non-interest income. You have Q1 is your dividend booking.
Yes.
Quarter, and you had a pretty decent dividend from MTN, and a pretty decent dividend from Stanbic IBTC, PFA. These are portfolio investments. For strategic reasons, which are giving us a sweet bonus of not just having the shares, delivering on the strategy that drove the investment, but also, we have a very strong dividend income stream, coming from those investments. The question around disposal of subsidiaries and losses associated with them for 2013, Shay, could you just give some color as to because I think the capital market ones, there are no losses expected. The disposal of ICB UK, no losses expected. I think on the whole,
with respect to the a number of these subsidiaries that have been disposed, for most of them, because the bank has started to make some provisions for them in 2012, we've given that we have started the transactions in terms of we had an idea, how much this will come to. So really, in terms of an aggregate basis, we don't expect to see any impact, in terms of on a net basis on P&L in 2013.
The only one that maybe would have had a bit of a challenge given where share prices on insurance companies are would have been WAPIC, but we are doing that by way of a spin-off. So there's going to be no P&L effect on WAPIC.
I think that was a question from Bumi on non-interest income in Q4. I don't know whether you still recall the Q3 presentation where we also said that we had also significant dividend income of about 800 million, MTN, AFC. We also had recoveries, which are recoveries from fully. So when a loan has been fully written off, any recovery that comes from those those type of assets typically go to other income. This was not recurring in Q4. Also, we had, you know, we saw some of the equity investment also in Q1. So, totaling about 3.3 billion, you know, came into the P&L. It actually is noted in the presentation that we made in Q3. So, really, this is what accounted for what you saw as a drop in Q4, because these things were non-recurring in Q4. Now, with respect to discontinued operations, clearly the largest of them is Côte d'Ivoire. So you had Burundi, ICB UK, Access Homes and Mortgages. So really, that's where the largest part. But it's one of, I mean, since we are taking out those subsidiaries, and it's coming from some operating expenses that been carrying, and correction of, you know, prior year retaining, you know, errors in the books of particularly Côte d'Ivoire.
ROE.
Yeah, in terms of the ROE, this is after-tax ROE. I don't know whether that answered. I think that was the question he was asking. Yes, is after-tax ROE.
But we are comparing like with like. So the 80% ROE for 2012, same basis, you know, is the projection for 2013 is 22%.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. It was really the other comprehensive income that's throwing things off a bit for me. So I wanted to be sure that PAT, when you say like for like, really is after that line as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So could we go on with the question?
We will now take our next question from Rila Adeniza of Stanbic IBTC. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Sorry about earlier. Some of my questions, I think, have already been asked. But I just wanted to get a sense of, you know, in terms of replacing the term funding, the expensive term funding, just a sense of how you see the market out there. Because, you know, there are many sort of pressures on some of the sort of maybe easier gains that have been in existence in the sector, and everybody's kind of competing for a low cost of funds. And I'm just trying to get a sense of how easy it will really be in the next few months to simply replace expensive term funding with cheap funding. And that kind of speaks to the outlook for your net interest margin for the year, which clearly has fallen quite sharply in Q1 versus the four-year number. My second question was also just with regard to the divestments. You were talking about reducing your shareholdings in Congo and Zambia, and DRC and Zambia. Is this like a prelude to a full exit, or and are you expecting local capital to come in, or are we talking about foreign capital coming into Zambia, you know, taking up those shareholdings? Just trying to get a feel for the ease or difficulty of executing that reduction there. And I wanted to clarify something about customer charges and issues that were resolved in Q1. I'm not sure I understood that correctly. Are you saying that net interest income in the first quarter was affected by some sort of issues with customers that gave rise to some amounts being paid back? Or if you could just clarify that for me, I wasn't sure that I caught it thoroughly. Thanks.
Yeah, Shay was actually talking about Q1 2012. We had when we acquired Intercontinental, we had significant requests from customers for refunds running into billions of naira, you know, significant. And you know, we in certain instances we took, based on patterns that we observed in terms of the requests and the rate of success, if you like, when our internal auditors confirmed these requests, you know, we made certain preemptive provisions. In certain instances, when we found that maybe we were overly aggressive, or when we actually resolved those cases and it was to our benefit, obviously we would write back the accrual that was made. So that's what she was talking about, not 2013.
Okay.
Now, with respect to NIM, okay, there is a significant cost of funds advantage of being a tier one bank, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, as far back as 2008, 2005, we set our sights on getting there. I mean, when you do your analysis, you know that Tier 1 bank cost of funds has anything as much as a 300, 400 basis points advantage over Tier 2 banks. The reality is that there are three reasons for this. The first is they have access to premium multinational and top local corporates whose cash management mandates, generate huge sums of current account balances, and at most you are paying 1.5-2%, if that. Okay. Now, unless you sign on such a name, you just don't have access to that pool of funds. And Tier 1 status gives you, entry into names like that. And I mean, to be frank, I don't want it to sound like name dropping, but since we celebrated our Tier 1 status, we've signed on one or two major oil producing companies that we've been knocking on their doors for 7-8 years, and I mean, I won't go beyond that. So already we're seeing single corporates that have balances of 5, 6, 7 billion naira, to whom we're not paying, anything. That's number one. The second, of course, is that with our branch network and our retail pool, we have 5 million or, almost 6 million account holders. So we've done the merger and settled on the integration, now we're driving the volumes in that segment. The reality is that prior to Central Bank's new bankers tariff requesting for essentially what is 3% interest on savings accounts, these savings accounts were generating, we were paying, little or nothing on those savings accounts. And for example, in the first quarter of the year, we grew, those balances, and actually we are growing more the current account side than the savings account, but we grew CASA balances from our personal and business banking by about, 12-15 billion naira? The third thing is simply the fact that from a risk standpoint, we have one of the most conservative balance sheets of any bank. Our risk ratings from S&P, Fitch, and Augusto are top four Nigerian bank ratings, and therefore, of course, there's a ratings advantage that we get when it comes to negotiating deposits. Frankly speaking, in the first quarter, we paid out about 80 billion of this expensive money, and we've replaced it essentially with CASA. And so in terms of replacing the money, we have no issues whatsoever. We are totally confident to the point of, we shouldn't get to that point, but we are totally confident that we will replace it, this is what First Bank, Zenith, GT, and UBA always do. It's just good to be in their company now. Now, with respect to the divestment process, I think also it helps that the Central Bank has issued a circular recently that clarifies the options available to Nigerian banks, with respect to their subsidiaries. I think there's much more flexibility, that has come out from those things. And I, frankly speaking, that will address your concerns, really.
Thank you. I think I'm good.
So can we take some more questions?
We will take the next question from Sogi Solanka of Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Sogi Solanka of Renaissance Capital. My first question is, if you could give us some clarity as to the scope for revenue synergies from the acquisition in 2013. Okay, so what kind of revenue synergies do you expect to come through this year? You're talking about retail banking, but in nominal terms, if you put some numbers to what you're expecting. The second one, probably more for Shea. In computing your NPL ratio of 5.3%, in looking through your annual report, what I noticed was you don't include collective impairment. Zenith Bank, for example, includes collective impairment. So if I do that for you, your NPL ratio is actually about 7.2%. So is there any particular reason why you don't include collective impairment? The third question is, if you could kindly give us an update on Capital Oil, where exactly you're sitting on that transaction and the impact on your numbers for 2015. And finally, what's the outlook for NIMS this year? Collapse in Q1. What are we looking at towards the end of the year in terms of net interest margin? Thanks.
Can we take a couple more questions?
We'll take our next question from Adeolu Umatula of ARM Investment Managers. Please go ahead.
Right, good afternoon. Just a couple of questions. First of all, the AMCON bond sales, I was wanting you to clarify, is this an ongoing thing? Because I think, just to know, is this something that's an ongoing process? Is something that you can sell more? And what sort of charges do you think would happen in case you need more liquidity on that front, even though you've given some positive insight as to how you expect to make that up? The second question really relates to the non-interest revenue. We've talked a lot about that today, but I'm just, a bit curious. If you engine the non-interest revenue growth on improvement on the enlarged platform that you have and larger number of customers, and you have already had that through most of 2012, how does it seem to you that, what we've seen in terms of Q1 can be sustainable, because it's still a big jump over the 2012 quarterly average? And I know Sergi asked that earlier, but I wasn't sure if you sort of addressed that particular question. So I'd be glad if you just share some insight on those two.
Okay, let me the question that Mr. Sholanke asked with respect to the revenue synergies, I think also is similar to the second question that the gentleman from ARM asked. Let me begin by saying that based on our model, the central bank approved tariff on banking will impact our retail banking business on a fee basis by something like 1.8 billion naira per quarter. Okay? In terms of the COT reduction and the interest, minimum interest on savings account balances. But our growth rates are such that from the second half of the year, we are confident that the net effect will still be positive. But assuming the central bank had not introduced these new policies, they basically cost us some 10 billion naira in revenue synergies there. Let me just put it that way. So that gives you an idea of how strong, the revenue synergies that we are beginning to see, are. And that is probably why we were quite conservative in our 2013 Q2 forecast, because we were not too sure to what degree the proposed at that time bankers tariff would be, in terms of hitting and affecting some of the revenue synergies that we seek. But on the whole, retail banking at the gross earnings point will still be up versus last year about 25%. Victor is just correcting me. Retail banking gross earnings will be up 30%. Now, if you think about the base, which is about four times the Access Bank retail banking base pre-acquisition, you can begin to appreciate the contribution of retail banking to our total earnings now. Beyond the sheer volume contribution, obviously, as a diversification of earnings play, and of course reduction of concentration, it just enhances our earnings quality. So scope for revenue synergies are high. The distractions that integration would prevent us from driving have been largely dealt with, and you will begin to see a lot of this in the second half of the year.
With respect to Capital Oil, we have not been very voluble on the state of things for two reasons. The first is that we extracted an extremely favorable settlement from Capital Oil, extremely favorable settlement from Capital Oil based on the strength of our legal position. But one of the conditionalities of that extremely favorable settlement was that we are not allowed to publicly comment on it, neither can we publish it. However, I think it was sufficiently strong for our company secretary to issue a notice to the whole world to say that we are confident that we will recover the amounts outstanding. Nonetheless, in terms of, we have some, I don't want to prejudice certain legal issues, but our confidence remains very strong. We have no concern. However, I must add that for obvious reasons, in terms of interest income recognition, you know, we are suspending it. Now, on the AMCON bond sales, the question was, do we intend to sell more AMCON bonds? The answer is, the reason why we sold AMCON bonds in 2012 does not exist, and we do not see or envisage any scenario where it will come up again, because we've dealt with that issue with finality. Nonetheless, we must also state that, in a sense, the decision to sell AMCON bonds also proved, in a sense, providential, because as a single exposure item on our balance sheet, the AMCON bonds constituted, 32%. Then, about 40% of our balance sheet, and therefore was attracting a lot of attention around, explain to us what AMCON bonds are, can you ever sell any of these things, and so on, from risk analysts and so on. So what the sale of the AMCON bonds did do was that it proved that, even though at a cost, they are liquid, and you established a basis by which you could stress our liquidity and come up with a sensible result, not a question where it was a black box where if you stress our liquidity, somebody could suggest that, yes, you could never get out of these instruments. So what it has done is that it has provided significant reassurance, to risk analysts with respect to our ability to sell these bonds if we ever needed to.
Okay, I think Soji also asked a question around the NPL ratios and why the collective impairment portion is not included. I think two things. First of all, this is based on practice, and given that the collective impairment part changes very quickly, it's based on a portfolio approach. So really, for you to begin to tie that down, every time will be, and it's not a significant portion of the book. So this is based on practice, around the fact that what do you consider as NPL, because this can change overnight. What the push, because it's collective, is based on, like I said earlier, on a portfolio basis. So that's the reason why we tend not to include it, and our auditors as well do not also include it when they look at the NPL ratios.
Can we ask some more questions, please?
Our next question comes from Tunde Ojo of Harding Lovner. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for the call. I have three questions. The first is around your loan growth. I recall during the Q3 call, you were very optimistic that you're going to grow your loan in Q4 because of the 350 million euro bond effects you had. So I just want to get a clarity of why that did not happen. I think you were giving guidance around an oil and gas transaction that you were expecting. So I just wanted to know why that didn't happen. The second question I have is, I have a bit of disconnect between your high liquidity ratio and you acquiring time deposits, you know, you basically have this.
We can't hear you, please. Could you speak up, please?
Did you hear the first question?
Yeah,
we have the first one. The second one.
Okay, all right. Okay, good. The second question is, I have a disconnect between your high liquidity ratio and you acquiring time deposits, basically increasing your cost of funding. So is it that these liquid assets and your liquidity ratio are not really cash-like enough that you can use to reduce your time deposit? Because if you don't need those expensive deposits, then why hold them? So I just want to get a bit of comfort around that. Then the third question I have is around your impairment charges in the last quarter. It basically jumped about $10 billion in the last quarter alone. And just looking at your NPL ratio. And
you're talking about Q4 2012, right?
Q4 2012, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that huge jump, I just wanted to see what led to that really. Is it deterioration in your asset portfolio? Or what exactly happened during that quarter? Thank you.
Okay. I think, thanks, Tunde. Let me begin by saying that our Eurobond proceeds were received Q3 2012. I don't think we ever gave guidance that we were going to start lending in Q4. We gave guidance that lending activities would pick up in 2013. In fact, actually, we were a bit robust in terms of detail with respect to our funding and liquidity plan on our foreign currency balance sheet. Now, with respect to the dollar loan you were talking about, the oil and gas transaction, the oil and gas transaction took place. The only thing that I would like to mention, however, is that you're also aware that, or you may be, there were significant delays in the receipt of sovereign discount notes from the Ministry of Finance for players in the oil and gas sector. And in Q4, the payments started to come in. So there was huge reduction of loans from those who were importing PMS. I'm talking about the downstream petroleum importers, which more than negated all the dollar loans that we did, you know, both in Q4 and Q1, 2013. Now, yes, we have a high liquidity ratio. We still maintain it. I don't know if you recall that when I was answering the question around AMCON bonds, I said that the fact that we sold the AMCON bonds, okay, answered a question in the minds of several analysts, risk analysts particularly, as to whether AMCON bonds in Nigeria actually have a secondary market. Okay, so the issue is that they are liquid, but the cost of exiting AMCON bonds is so significant that unless you have an extremely compelling reason to do so, you would probably shy away from doing it. In our case, what we did was we sold AMCON bonds, okay, as well as took money from non-bank financial institutions to retire the entirety of interbank funding that came with the acquisition of Intercontinental Bank. And the reason we did this was simple. Since 2002, up to the point in time that Access Bank acquired Intercontinental Bank, Access Bank was not a bank that funded itself from the interbank. And this is just out of our conservative and prudent approach to banking, and the fact that in Nigeria, our experience has shown that interbank reliance is a slippery road to corporate challenges for a bank. And we were significantly uncomfortable with this interbank position, that when interest rates in the interbank rose, and then we saw the early signs of demarketing amongst banks, you know, based on who had money in interbank, we just took the decision to exit interbank totally. And if you look from our books, from basically the end of 2012 and it continues, you won't see interbank borrowings from
from a Nigerian bank perspective. So those were the reasons.
Thanks. So and this, just as a follow-up to that, on this AMCON bond, what percentage of this liquidity ratio or your liquid asset is still in this AMCON bond? Or maybe if you can give me a size of the AMCON bond held on the balance sheet, that would be helpful.
His question was, what if you, just total liquid assets, AMCON bonds, AMCON bonds are, total liquid assets are about 800 billion, and AMCON bonds are, so I would say that they contribute about a quarter of total liquid assets.
Thank you.
Okay, let me put it this way. I think I get where you're going. Put it this way. In our stress test, okay, even if we didn't have the AMCON bonds, we are still more than central bank minimum liquidity requirements.
Okay, great. That's what I wanted to find out. And the last thing is on the impairment charges, the third question.
Okay, I think I've explained this earlier, but I think I'll just explain it again. I don't know whether you have the financials, the audited financials, so that I can use it to explain it properly. Page 127. Now, if you look at the page 127, these impairment charges have two components. You have the specific impairments and the collective impairments. On a specific basis, we actually had a write-back, provisions. However, on the collective impairment basis, up till the end of 2011, what we had done was to, given the fact that you need to collect data, what we had done was that to base collective impairment on a portfolio basis. Now that we've done IFRS for 4 years now, we've now gotten enough data to be able to predict, to come up with some loss ratios, and therefore that enabled us to now begin to do it on an obligor rating basis. And therefore, so this is a step change and a one-time change in the methodology, going forward. So really what you see is the change in methodology, not that the portfolio or the impairment has gone off. And that's what I'm saying, so it's not on a specific basis. Is more on the collective basis and is the one of coming off of the methodology change.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I think we can take one more set of questions. We are meant to sign off at 3.
Okay, our next question comes from DSR Masangwe of Leg A. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. I think my question is more like what the previous caller really asked. I'm finding it difficult as well to kind of reconcile, you have a very high liquidity ratio, very low loan-to-deposit ratio, a very backloaded debt distribution, but you go pick up quite expensive deposits. I noticed on the balance sheet, you end up placing very little, but supported by some reasonable end up being deposits. They just wanted to find out maybe put it simply, why are you picking deposits that you seem not to be earning a return on or a spread? And then the second is related to your second quarter guidance. If you can shed a bit of some more light, then just for us, to get a feel of your expectations, Q2 and maybe Q3. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me say, I think this is a very opportune time for me to talk about our operating philosophy as a bank, about sustainable banking principles and our belief in running a bank, not just for today, but for the very long term. Banking, interestingly, is one business that has almost equally important as the shareholders are customers. Some would argue that those depositors may even stand higher in terms of responsibility of a bank. And for this reason, you cannot run a bank in any manner that would put the funds of those depositors at risk. It's also important for us to note that indeed, actually, the step change transaction that we
we entered into in 2011 and acquired a bank called Intercontinental Bank was as a result of the fact that the bank was run in such a manner that it ran itself to the detriment of its customers and or depositors, and the rest is history. The last thing that we are going to do is run the hazard of our new position, flush with liquidity, strong capital adequacy, and expand our loan book, you know, in almost reckless manner. The decision by the board and management of the bank was to adopt a moderate risk appetite consistent with our sustainable banking philosophy and set for ourselves loan growth targets that would be consistent with the type of risk ratings and confidence that we want our customers and the markets to have of our institution. We have since commenced that, and we have given guidance that this year loan growth would be in the region of 15%. It should be noted, however, that we have had past years as a bank where we have grown our loans even in excess of 30%. So our ability to grow loans is not in doubt. But with our size and our sustainable banking philosophy, we want to grow loans sustainably, and we want to ensure that the loans that we book are loans, you know, that are repaid by our borrowers. So I just thought that I would take the opportunity at this juncture to highlight that. And I think that it's important that even as I say this, I mention the S&P view on the Nigerian bank loan market. It's very interesting that S&P is sending signals of caution that we must watch, and the expectation that come 2014, come 2015, there are going to be NPL challenges for Nigerian banks. Why do I say this? Similar cautions were sent out in 2006 by S&P following the capitalization efforts of Nigerian banks and our coming of age. And it's so interesting that by 2009, a lot of those things that they predicted came to pass. So Access Bank is here for today and here for tomorrow and here for the long run. And therefore, it's important that we have a very balanced approach to growth that ensures that the loans that we give out, you know, are always repaid and do not in any way affect the ability of the organization to give returns on a sustainable basis to its shareholders. Now, with respect to the AMCON bonds and the fact that the AMCON bonds are liquid assets and contribute to our high liquidity ratios and also our high loan-to-deposit ratios. Our good loan-to-deposit ratios. I guess from a finance standpoint, if you are holding government securities, the assumption, of course, is therefore that they are liquid. And, if you have what appears to be a high stock of liquid assets, why would you want to raise deposits? Particularly more so if they are term deposits. We explained in 2012, I think during our Q3 conference call, that AMCON bonds, whilst liquid, do not have an active secondary market. And if you want to sell AMCON bonds, at least for now, you would have to offer them to the central bank. And the central bank, in computing the discount rate for AMCON bonds, adopted, if you like, the most conservative rate
that, you know, that could take place in the market, and this is what they do for all banks. So the actual step of selling AMCON bonds from a profit-making standpoint is very unattractive and could actually be bettered by raising high expensive money if you need the money just for a temporary period of time, which is exactly what we did. We raised money for between 6 months and 9 months on the assumption that we would replace that money with cheaper current account money over time. And this is exactly what we are doing. Out of the total sum of about 140 billion raised, we have retired half of it in Q1, and we aim to retire the balance in the second quarter. So that explains why we took expensive money in the second quarter, in the third and fourth quarters of 2012. What I will do, though, is that if you could please send Sheyi Kumakwai an email. Sheyi, what's your email address? Oh, you know. Okay, he knows it. Please send Sheyi Kumakwai an email, or Sheyi will send you a detailed explanation of that decision and a detailed explanation of the workings of AMCON bonds and the numbers around how AMCON bonds are traded by the central bank. And then it gives you a full view.
Okay, thank you very much. But also, I see the number of shares have gone up. What happened? Did you guys exercise some options or what?
Number of shares?
Yeah.
Number of shares? What number of shares?
Number of shares in issue.
Oh, the bank. The number of shares. Oh, okay. This following the merger, or rather, yeah. Well, if you like, following the acquisition of Intercontinental Bank, we did a special distribution of shares to our shareholders to reward them for their loyalty and support. Well, I guess it was a good Christmas present, 2012.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you very much. I don't know if you have time, just shedding a bit more light on the second quarter guidance. The one which you published some time back.
You mean... Oh, okay, right. What in particular do you want to know?
Just in terms of performance, I will probably... it kind of came on the low side of our expectations, so we are expecting more like a difficult first half.
Okay, so you were expecting something like, 14 billion or something like that, right? No, you're right. I mean, was that the figure you're expecting?
No, I don't have my model with me, but...
Well, no, but I think your model is right. The issue is that we made adjustments for the central... You know, the central bank has just issued a new tariff for banking in Nigeria. And the new tariff, we were aware, is effective April 1 this year. The new tariff makes it mandatory that we pay something like 3% on all savings accounts, as well as reduces commission on turnover from 5 per mil to 3 per mil, as well as caps the amount you can charge for several retail banking services. Now, if you can imagine that we have about 7% of the retail banking market, the implications can be quite high. So we modeled something like a 3 billion naira hit per quarter. Let us assume that you do not grow your volume to deal with this. So that's what basically accounted for it.
Okay, all right, thank you very much.
So I think... We can round off now, unless there are any really burning questions. So thank you very much for participating in our conference call. Thank you to all our listeners. And we look forward to talking to you in 3 months' time. God bless.
Thank you. That will conclude today's conference call. Thank you for your participation, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect.